Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of July. And we're going to have, because yesterday, of course, was the 4th of July, and I hope your weekend was a good one, we thought we would have all things political on the 5th of July on Tuesday. And Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This morning, the director of the FBI said the Bureau would not recommend criminal charges in Hillary Clinton's handling of classified information. But James Comey did say she was being extremely careless in using a personal email address and server for sensitive information. Could we be seeing a landslide victory in 2016? The Electoral College appears to be in Hillary's favor, 320 votes to Trump's 218, at least at this point in the race. But Trump is competitive in some of the 14 swing states. We'll talk about which ones and why. Julian has looked at VP picks for both candidates. We'll talk about what they need and who they're looking at. Bill Clinton's meeting with Attorney General Loretta Lynch last week has been called immensely bad judgment. Donald Trump said it was terrible and such a big story that even the liberal media is making it a big story. Julian has written about whether or not we might be seeing some kind of gun control legislation. We'll talk to him about that and whatever else you have on your agenda today. Julian is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, and he is the author of quite a few books, most recently The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He has a new podcast series, perfect for this year, Politics and Polls, and the first episode looks at 2016 in the context of the 64 election when Lyndon Johnson crushed Barry Goldwater, and so some of the podcast is about whether or not we could see another landslide, or does today's political environment make that impossible? Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Julian Zelizer, always a pleasure. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Hello. Great to have you here. So what did you make of the no criminal indictment, but some pretty harsh words from the director of the FBI for Hillary Clinton?
Well, the good news is it obviously removes any kind of indictment and legal proceeding, which is probably the most significant part of it. The last thing she wanted was that to come out now, which would have jeopardized her candidacy, which would have instantly led to demands for a different Democratic candidate. That's off the table. And she has this report that she can use to say, I didn't do anything criminally wrong, even if, as I've said, I've made a mistake. But the political attacks will continue. They would have whatever the report said. And there's enough critical language in the report about her judgment that you can imagine how Donald Trump and other Republicans will use this to raise questions about how she would do as commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm. She also, it hasn't been a great week for her, last week's meeting on the tarmac of the airport between Loretta Lynch and her husband, Bill Clinton. A lot of people were saying this was really a bad thing to do.
Yeah, it's really one of those moments that's hard to understand what Bill Clinton was thinking. We talk a lot about his great political savvy and his skills, but there's many moments like this. We've seen this in 2008 already, where he says something or does something which, simply observing it, doesn't make any sense. And by having that short meeting just a week before this report comes out, he basically set up the argument that Donald Trump will make, that this was a corrupt process and it can't really be trusted. So I do think it was a mistake. And even if it was harmless, the conversation, the Clintons have to be more careful about something they always seem to forget. Perception matters in American politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about perception, Donald Trump took a lot of criticism for this tweet that described Hillary Clinton as crooked and had an image that it would appear that the image came from a white supremacist literature.
Yes, that is true. And this is not the first time that this issue has come up, which I think makes it more damaging when he's used rhetoric. He's used images that are associated with far-right organizations, whether he's talking about immigration or Hillary Clinton. And, you know, at first there wasn't much of a response from the Trump camp, although now he's moved from apologizing and taking it off to being somewhat aggressive with people who are criticizing him. We don't know why that came up, whether it was a mistake or others think it's a, you know, targeted effort to play to both nationalist groups in the United States, but also just to play into some of the social and racial and ethnic hatred that is much more widespread in the electorate.
Are there a lot of people like that? I mean, does it do him any good politically to try and reach out to those people?
Well, I think he does it in different ways. Obviously, when you're talking about right-wing extremists, it's a limited number of people, and so you're not going to win an election by doing that, and you certainly lose a lot more than you gain. But, you know, at various points in this campaign, from when the primary started, he does play to, again, social tensions that are much more widespread. So when he's attacking political correctness, for example, it's often, you know, tapping into animosities about race and gender that probably do have a bigger hold in the electorate. He is the candidate of the white male, who he argues is endangered in modern America. And so I think sometimes this is part of a broader effort to make that case.
So I listened to your podcast and enjoyed it thoroughly. I'm glad you're doing it during this year. You asked whether or not we could see another landslide like the one we saw in 1964, and you, the historian, will have to remind us of that election, or does today's political environment make that impossible? Could we see a landslide, and are there parallels to 1964?
So 1964, again, Barry Goldwater, Republican from Arizona, who runs as a right-wing Republican and argues Republicans have to be much more conservative, faces off against Lyndon Johnson, who became president after Kennedy was assassinated. And Johnson devastates him. He wins a huge mandate, not just a large electoral college vote, but the perception that the vote was for Johnson to continue and to fulfill the liberal agenda. Democrats do great in the House. They have 295 seats. They have 68 seats in the Senate. And it was really a devastating moment for the GOP. And some are wondering, and some Democrats are hoping that's going to happen again, that Donald Trump is such a disastrous candidate that you're actually going to see, even in more conservative states, some Democratic victories. But it's much harder in this day and age. And I think that's what a lot of social scientists, for example, tell us. There's fewer Republicans who, even with Donald Trump at the top of their ticket, are going to swing over to the Democratic side. And so most likely we're going to see a campaign once again that plays out in a handful of states, a handful of swing states like Ohio and Florida, which will ultimately dictate the outcome. And finally, it's hard in the House of Representatives to get huge changes anymore because districting, gerrymandering has become so perfected as a result of computer technology and campaign money that goes into these efforts that it's hard to swing the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. You did say in that podcast that he could make, Donald Trump, that is, a play for Ohio and Pennsylvania. Does he stand a good chance there?
He does. And, you know, I think Democrats who are too optimistic right now shouldn't be. We have, you know, made mistakes over and over as we analyzed how he would do in the primaries. Mm-hmm. And there is some evidence that, you know, he has support in areas that have been hurt economically, and places like Pennsylvania and Ohio are front and center, where jobs have left and Americans have been left behind to struggle. And his arguments, especially as he attacks free trade, do resonate in some of those communities. And so I think, you know, right now Hillary Clinton still has a lead in most of those states, but it's not a lead that should give Democrats great confidence that those are secure places.
Mm-hmm. And Yemwei, you look at least at the moment at the Electoral College, it's 320 for her and 218 for him, right?
Absolutely. Any Republican would face an uphill battle this year. And that's something the GOP knew going in, and that's part of why many were not happy that Trump was going to be the person who would have to win over all these swing states. So that's why his campaign has to be more than simply clever tweets or clever appearances on television. He is going to need organization and money to compete in these swing states because he needs more than she does to win this election.
Where's he going to get the money, Professor Zelizer?
Well, that's been an issue. The first fundraising numbers were not good. He barely had any money. It was kind of shocking, I think, to many people watching. And Hillary Clinton is a juggernaut when it comes to fundraising. So he has ramped up his effort. There's many donors, though, who are still skittish. So this is an example of why, you know, his vice presidential pick might matter. I think there are some Republicans who are hoping he picks someone who the Koch brothers, for example, are comfortable with, or who other donors are comfortable with, so they could start giving more money to him in a way that they are not willing to do if he picks a Donald Trump light as the other part of his ticket. You know, the other potentially as is to get a lot of small donations. He does have very loyal followers, and if he put together a fundraising strategy that would replicate Democrats in 2008, you could imagine him raising money that way as well. But right now there is no infrastructure. He is running a brand new kind of campaign where there is no secret, you know, behind the screen. I don't think his own advisors know how he's going to raise this money.
Mm-hmm. You did some interesting pieces, and we'll get to Clinton in a moment, but you talked about his needing somebody who could raise money, somebody who could withstand the media onslaught, somebody who counteracts xenophobia, racism, and sexism, and somebody with appeal in Pennsylvania and Ohio. So who fits the bill? Those are a lot of different categories.
Yeah, you know, he is usually vice presidential picks are not going to be that consequential in campaigns, and the conventional wisdom is that what you're really trying to do is not make a mistake. And so the goal is not to pick someone who actually hurts your campaign like Sarah Palin did for John McCain in 2008. But in this case, it's different, given how fragile his whole candidacy is and how many unknowns there are about him. So there are many members of Congress or former members of Congress, for example, like Jeff Sessions or Bob Corker or Newt Gingrich, who is the Speaker of the House, all of whom would help, if they were the pick, give some confidence that the White House would be able to govern if Donald Trump was president. Someone who came up in the news this weekend, Joni Ernst, mm-hmm. Is someone who's very close to the Koch brothers, and she's also seen as a different kind of Republican, both rambunctious, but not part of the Washington system. She's someone else that's being considered both to change the perception of who Trump is and what he stands for, but also an effort to start getting donors to giving money. So those are a few of the people who have been floated around. Obviously, Chris Christie might help a little with the confidence in governance building, and he's also someone who is remarkably loyal to Donald Trump, regardless of the costs.
Wouldn't he need somebody, as Bush found in Cheney, controversial as he became, somebody who knows his or her way around the world and around government? Joni Ernst doesn't have a lot of experience yet, does she?
No, she doesn't. And so she is not someone who will solve this governance problem for him. And I think at this point, again, no one knows what he's thinking. So unlike Hillary Clinton or other candidates, it's harder to say, you know, you have a decent gauge of where this is going to go. Because for all we know, he's going to pick someone who isn't on any of the lists. But to pick someone with no governance experience or very little governance experience and very little understanding of policy or relationships would be a high risk for him. So at least from what he's said and from what we're seeing, he's going to lean towards someone who's antithetical to what his whole campaign is about. He's the insurgent. He's from outside Washington. But he might very well pick someone who is from that city, lives and breathes it more than his supporters will like.
And Hillary Clinton, you've written, needs to look at, well, she needs to look at who's going to be a good partner in governance and who will do no harm to the ticket. Who should she pick if she really wants all those people who voted for Bernie Sanders? And there were millions of them. You've got a very progressive liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and they're not very enthused about her. So what does she do?
Yeah, she has this tough choice between a VP pick that excites and energizes many Democrats who don't love her, or a pick that's just so utterly safe, at least on paper, that nothing can go wrong. her instinct is obviously toward the latter. That's where her tendency is, and that's why Tim Kaine, for example, is someone from Virginia who is discussed all the time as the safest of safe picks, although he suffered from a little bit of a scandal this weekend. If she wants to energize progressives, there's three big names. One is obviously Elizabeth Warren, who is really a hero and champion for all the causes that Sanders has been talking about. A second is Sherrod Brown from Ohio, senator from Ohio, who's kind of a champion of blue-collar workers, a very effective speaker, although it would cost Democrats a seat in the Senate. Tom Perez is another person, the Secretary of Labor, who's very well-liked in the progressive community. He's not as high-profile as Elizabeth Warren, but he's someone else who's being considered if that ends up being her goal. And finally, Cory Booker is someone who is not as high on the list, a senator from New Jersey and former mayor of Newark, who's a kind of younger, exciting Democrat who's been very progressive on issues like criminal justice reform.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any sense of where she's going to go? I read the Times had an interesting piece yesterday about how she plans to, according to people who know her well, have half of her people who are with her in government be female. It led me to believe that maybe she is going to announce a woman to be VP as well.
She might. Again, there's a part of a Clinton team, including her, who would be worried about that. And she has a problem with white male voters, and she is facing alpha white male candidate right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure, the historic nature of her campaign is already there. Add to it a female VP pick. It would be truly exciting and energizing to many, many, many Americans. But she will weigh that with the risk of going too far in a campaign where she seems to be ahead already. And I think that's part of the pushback she certainly feels with someone like Warren, not just her progressive values, but is a two-female ticket in this day and age still too much and not playing it safe.
So when you called Trump's selection of a historic nature, you would not say the same about her selection?
In terms of who she selects,
right.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be as consequential. I think her campaign, unless she picks someone who turns into a big political disaster and actually costs her support, I think it's pretty much set in stone. People have feelings about her. They know what they like. They know what they don't like. Her agenda's out there. Her style's out there. And so you just compliment her with someone who strengthens some aspects of the campaign, it's not going to have a dramatic effect. But with Trump, you're dealing with such an outlier, an insurgent, an uncertain candidate that the pick is much more consequential. If he picks someone, poorly, it could instantly sink his whole campaign, which is already just, it's hanging in there. And so I think that's why it's more important.
We're going to welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political for Tuesday instead of Monday because we were celebrating the 4th yesterday. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He is the author of a number of books, and he now has, for those of you who love politics, you can imagine he does this very well. He does everything well. He's got a podcast. It's a new series, Politics and Polls, and the first episode has been released, and it looks at the historical comparison between the 64 election and the 2016 election. We've already brought up a number of different issues. Feel free to comment on them. The VP picks, who would make sense and who would excite you on the Republican and Democratic side. We're talking about the big news today that the FBI found that there would be no charges against Hillary Clinton for use against of her personal email, although he did, the director of the FBI, call Mrs. Clinton extremely careless in using the personal email address and took her to task for quite a while. What do you think about that? What do you think about Bill Clinton's meeting with Loretta Lynch last week and why those kinds of things keep happening? Possibility of gun legislation, we can discuss that, and Susan Collins moves in that direction. And That's a few of the things we're talking about. Here's how you can talk about them. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We have lines open for you right now. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest. It's all things political for this Tuesday. And let's start with Dorothea in Hill Point. Hi.
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 I just wanted to kind of mention today that how the guest feels about Hillary going campaigning with Obama, or Obama going campaigning with Hillary and riding on Air Force One with him. Isn't that kind of improper?
No, it's not improper, and, you know, presidents certainly can campaign and come out in support of candidates. Trump has already raised questions about her being, obviously, on Air Force One, but, you know, this certainly happens with vice presidents all the time, and the campaigning itself is really nothing unusual. Again, perception matters, and so I think President Obama, as he gets deeper into this race, needs to be careful about giving Republicans anything like that. But he's going to be a big part of the campaign, President Obama. I think given his approval ratings, you're going to hear a lot from him. He's a powerful weapon that the Democrats can wield.
I would imagine he's going to be very, very effective voice for her. He's a good campaigner.
Yeah. He is. I mean, he's in some ways become a better campaigner in the last few years once he's done with it than I've seen, certainly in 2008 or 2012, not simply in high-level oratory, but in his willingness to unleash pretty tough attacks and speak in a blunt fashion, which we haven't seen of him. But he's going to be very good just bringing to the table his record, bringing to the table his gravitas and his success right now in the approval rating. So we're going to see a lot from him, and I think Hillary Clinton has made it clear she is going to connect her candidacy to his presidency as if she were the vice president.
Mm-hmm. Pete and Nina, hi.
Hey, am I on air?
Yes, Pete, go ahead.
Cool. First of all, love the show. Second of all, I wanted to bring up the topic of climate change and just sort of get your read on why we haven't been hearing more about it. You know, we're facing two radically different proposals from both Donald and Hillary as to how they're going to go about addressing that problem, or whether it was even a problem in the first place. And I'd just like to know why Hillary maybe isn't hitting Donald as hard as she could on that issue.
Well, it's a big issue, and it's one that I think really resonates with a lot of key constituencies within the Democratic Party, but also some of these moderate Republicans or independents in states that are going to determine this election. And, you know, my guess is you'll hear more about it. You did hear from Hillary Clinton about it. Her and Sanders were often debating it. He was in favor of a tax, a carbon tax, which is something she will not come out in favor of right now, although she's been pretty strong on making it clear that this will be front and center in her agenda, and she's going to support all kinds of initiatives, including clean energy. So I think it will be part of the campaign. Donald Trump's very clearly going to position himself as someone who doesn't believe very much in climate change as an idea. And I think that's somewhere he hopes to garner support from a lot of business people who are not enthused about the regulations that are proposed.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece on there may be a sliver of hope in some kind of gun safety legislation. Susan Collins, does she have a bill? Is that going to have a hearing at some point, Julian?
Well, that's what the sit-in was about, and Collins is trying to break through what's the most dramatic gridlock I think we see in Washington at this point, where despite repeated shootings, mass shootings involving these kinds of weapons, gun control is dead on arrival when it reaches the House and Senate. Collins is trying to break through with this measure that would prohibit guns from going to people on the no-fly list. There's some liberals who are unhappy with that because they don't like the no-fly list to begin with, and this gives it a kind of legitimacy. But her effort is to do something small, something very targeted, and hope it's a breakthrough so more is possible. I don't know. It was stifled early on. Mitch McConnell has no interest in it. But the Democrats have been working in the last week to build support in the district. It has a lot of support publicly, some kind of regulation. And so I don't think Democrats are going to give this up right now. And it works with election needs. This is a way to once again show that the GOP is off center.
Thanks very much for your call, Pete. We go to Jeff in Madison next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Yeah, well, I am wondering.
I'm sorry, Jeff. You're going to have to call us back. The phone line is just so bad, I can't hear you. Richard in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Can you ask the guest his opinion on why the funding for Zika virus research is being held up? And what his thoughts are, both political parties, why they're not supporting it, and the if he believes that there's dire consequences to not funding it?
Well, you know, it's pretty clear that the funding is necessary, and I don't think it's a point of controversy outside of Washington that this is something we need to address. So this isn't an issue of great contention outside of politics. But inside of politics, it is, and it's gotten tied up into the same kind of partisan battles that we have been watching. And you have a Republican Congress, which is very reluctant to give way on anything at this point, from budgetary matters to public health care matters to gun control matters, as they are thinking of the election, as they are thinking of giving President Obama any more reason to be able to boost his public approval ratings. And it's gridlocked because of that partisan dimension. The money is needed, but this is not unlike the gun control issue. Right now it's just very hard to break through this partisan mentality.
Let's talk just a little bit more about Donald Trump. You spent some time in the podcast discussing him. I guess I was surprised to hear either you say or the person you were talking with that Trump will probably get, it won't be a blowout in 2016, you would be surprised if he received anything lower than 42% of the vote. Where does all of that come from, and does that strike you as a rather high figure?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. So the guy I was speaking with in the podcast, Sam Wang, he's one of the number crunchers in American politics today, and he looks at polling and he looks at historical data, and what he's seen is that the map in 2012 isn't that much different than it is today. And, you know, because of how polarized the electorate has become, that even someone like Donald Trump doesn't really change the way many of the states look. There are just fewer and fewer voters who are really willing to commit to someone from a different party. And so even with all the stuff we're reading about Donald Trump, all those red states are going to remain red. And that's why this election comes down again to a handful of swing states. So this is about the power of polarization and the ways in which it's taken hold on the electorate over the last 20, 30 years, and we're seeing this play out in dramatic fashion, if that's true. Again, the thing we wonder, the issue we wonder is, do the polls not register a higher disapproval that we're actually going to see come election day? But right now, the map doesn't look that different.
And if you were to analyze for us, and please do, what historically has happened in the Republican Party that has given rise to Donald Trump, Professor Zelizer?
Part of this is a tension that's existed since the 1980s, and Republicans have tried to build, since Reagan, a pretty big coalition, and that included many working and middle-class Americans who were disaffected from the Democrats. But the policies of the Republican Party didn't really benefit those constituencies. Deregulation, supply-side economics, none of that helped. It only increased inequality in the U.S. And so this coalition has always been very frail. It's been full of tension, and we've tried to understand how did it stay together. Thomas Frank wrote a famous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Mm-hmm. He said Republicans talk about culture and social issues as a way to mask over this. But part of what you're seeing is that coalition is coming undone. And Trump is tapping into the anger of many Republicans who feel that their own party, not just the Democrats, are not helping them. And so that's part of it. Part of it, he's playing into just old-fashioned xenophobia and nativism and some of the social tensions that exist in the electorate. And when he talks about immigration, he's playing to those Americans who feel that's at the core of the problems that we're facing. And finally, his style of politics isn't unique to him. This kind of half celebrity politics, half slash and burn politics is we saw some of this with Sarah Palin
yes.
in 2008. And I think it's part of what some Republicans have been building on, Tea Party Republicans in Congress as well. And he's a product of Republican politics. He's not simply someone who's just remaking the party.
Thanks, Richard, for your call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I guess your guest, he was talking about Johnson and his program, President Johnson,
mm-hmm.
before, earlier. And I was wondering if he is familiar with the author L. Fletcher Prouty, Prouty, who was working with Oliver Stone on the movie JFK.
John, where are you going with this?
I'm talking about liberalism, how liberal presidents are always warmongering presidents, like Roosevelt, while he was a liberal Republican.
Okay.
And then liberal Wilson and liberal Johnson. All of these guys are people that mask their warmongering under the cover of domestic policy that is somewhat pro-social.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about Prouty. I've seen some things written about him. The bigger issue, that's obviously what interests Oliver Stone, is, you know, you have a history of presidents who are very liberal on domestic policy and then get involved in deep war. Certainly Johnson is the ultimate example of this, though there are many others in the 20th century, and some argue that President Obama has been very progressive on domestic policy, but has undertaken a pretty brutal drone policy and left much of the war on terror in place. You know, I don't see this as a product of some conspiratorial aspect of their politics where they're literally masking what they want to do overseas through domestic programs that satisfy people as they're getting involved in war. I think it's, first of all, you have many militaristic non-liberals, Republicans, moderate Democrats. War is something that's totally common in 20th and 21st century United States. And so I don't see why we need liberalism to explain it. And there are many liberals who are hawkish, in part because they fear the political consequences of being seen as too soft against whatever the threat mm-hmm. is, whether it's communism or terrorism. And so I think that's part of how they get in the bind, rather than, again, this secret plan they have hatched from the beginning.
Mason in Plum City. Hi, Mason.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Earlier in the show, your guest mentioned how the FBI not going to go through with criminal charges against Hillary was a good thing. I'm not a Hillary supporter, but I'm definitely not a Trump supporter because Trump is very unstable as a candidate. But wouldn't this entire situation of Hillary doing something obviously illegal and not being charged for it just prove Trump's point of the government being corrupt and essentially be free advertising for Trump?
All right. Interesting point.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, that's part of the bind. Whatever the report said, the political attacks,
sure.
One way or another, we're going to keep coming. Bill Clinton's meeting with Lynch just set up this argument that Trump would have made anyway, that the investigation was corrupt. Add to that the language you see from Comey saying there were many things that could have been violations. They were certainly sloppy. They were certainly, in some cases, risky. You are going to hear from the Republicans that the investigation was useless and that in some ways it just proves everything they're trying to say about Washington. And that's a problem she's going to have to deal with. But it's still better than the problem of being indicted going into her convention and potentially losing the nomination. And if there's one thing about the Clintons is they know how to campaign, they know how to govern facing these kind of attacks. Attacks mm-hmm. on their legitimacy, attacks on how scandalous they are. So I think this is an area in some ways she's comfortable with, and she can handle that. What she couldn't handle was the indictment.
Well, does she need to do something? Because whether or not we consider her trustworthy, she just doesn't have the confidence of the American people that she is trustworthy. So with these kinds of events taking place, what does it do to those numbers? And are you saying that doesn't make a difference to us whether or not we trust her?
Yeah, I don't think, I'm skeptical in the end there's going to be any great surge in the polls of Americans who trust her. Right? Mm-hmm. I think this is who she is, and her mistakes also are part of the package. And I think she's going to have a campaign that wins, even though many people don't trust her. I think that's in some ways how she has to plan the next few months, as opposed to having a whole strategy about reversing how people feel about her. She's been around so long now in politics, and we know so much about her. It's very hard to undo how people think about you. That's just true. That's why candidates always try to frame their opponent early on. And in this case, you know, Clinton, how we understand her is really, I think, set in stone. So obviously she has to be as honest as possible. She has to explain these mistakes in ways that are clear to people, even if they're not totally happy with what she did. But in the end, she's going to have to win with these kinds of problems with trust.
Can you remember a time in our recent history, or go back farther if you'd like, when we had two candidates who people either don't like at all, really dislike, very, very low favorability numbers, or very low likability numbers? We don't like these two candidates very much. Is that
I can't think of one. You know, in 2000, you had a bit of the problem with Al Gore. A lot of people didn't like him personally, and they weren't particularly enthused about him being the Democrat. And George Bush people liked personally, but there were a lot of concerns about could he handle this job, and was this just because he was the son of a president? So it wasn't the most exciting two presidents, I think, for a lot of the electorate. It's different than today, where people just actively dislike both of them. I can't think of something comparable. Usually, you know, the candidates who win usually generate a certain level of kind of enthusiasm and support. 68, you had a little of this. You know, Richard Nixon, he was doing better. He had rehabilitated his image since having been vice president, and always a very controversial Republican. But he was still not the most loved person in American politics. Hubert Humphrey, by 68, had turned from being really someone who liberals idolized into just another product of a broken Johnson administration, its war in Vietnam. So in 68, you had the two of them. You had George Wallace. It was a campaign where there wasn't a lot of love for the candidates. And so that's another example that comes to mind.
So what does it mean this year? Does it mean more people won't vote, Julian, or not?
I don't know. I mean, the balance this year is, yes, a lot of people don't like them. A lot of people are not enthused, but people are going to have very passionate feelings about, you know, certainly should Trump be in the White House. And I think that might generate a lot of voter interest, even if they don't like the candidates. I think the passion among many Democrats and even some Republicans to keep him out could strengthen voter turnout. And certainly the people who love Trump could turn out in pretty significant numbers. Right now, according to the polls, they will vote. There's going to be little holding them back.
Mm-hmm. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest for All Things Political. We're having it on a Tuesday of this week, which we do if there's a holiday on a Monday, because we don't want to miss our weekly show, All Things Political. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society, other books as well. And he has just launched a new podcast series for all of you who love politics, and that means everybody listening. It's titled Politics and Polls. And the first episode looks at the election of 1964 and makes comparisons with what's happening now. 800-486-8655. Back with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Claire in Madison, our next caller. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. My favorite Wisconsin Public Radio show of the whole week.
Thanks, Claire.
I thought of a second comment, if you could bear with me while I was waiting. for the professor. One, as I understand it, 40% of the voters in this country are independent. And if that's true, then neither Republican nor Democratic candidate can win without those independent votes. But the original reason I called is to get his comment on, I think Hillary's biggest problem now and in the future is potentially Bill Clinton with his poor judgment, like boarding the plane to meet with Ms. Lynch and back in Massachusetts during the primaries. What was he thinking going to the polling place, shaking people's hands? And being a former president, who's going to rein him in?
Professor
Zelda. Good questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, that poll on 40% being independent, I think it's much exaggerated. A lot of other polling work that really tries to understand how do people actually vote, how do the people who respond to that actually vote, finds that the electorate is much more partisan. And some say the number of true independents is under 10%. Some say as low as, you know, 5, 6, or 7% of the electorate. So I'm not a pollster, so I can't tell you the exact number, but I don't think that 40% is really very accurate, and it doesn't reflect the kind of elections we've seen in the last 5 or 6 election cycles. They're still important voters, and certainly in the swing states, you're literally competing for very small numbers of voters. So even a small percentage becomes very relevant. And on the question of Bill Clinton, you know, it's nothing new. This is a flaw that he has always had, his personal problems, his relationships when he was in Arkansas, his decision to have the relationship with Monica Lewinsky, as he knew the Republicans were out to get him and investigating him. All of this is part of a continuum of where he doesn't always have the most restraint or the best sense about what he should be doing when he knows and is very attuned to the fact he works in a politically toxic environment and one where there are many adversaries. And his problems now become Hillary Clinton's problems. And she will have to rein him in. The campaign has already tried to be careful, I think, in how much they use him. It's been much less, I think, than 2008. But this will be an ongoing challenge. And certainly if he wants his wife to win, which he does, he is going to have to think through some of the public actions and statements that he makes and takes.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. He doesn't think it through, right? But maybe.
Right, the thing is that sometimes has been a benefit to him. So people like how genuine he is, and they like how he can instantly do something or say something that speaks perfectly to the mm-hmm. moment. And I think they like that he will do what he wants sometimes because he's real, and people like that about him. But, you know, there's a cost to that. And, you know, especially in this day and age when everything is being watched, everything is being scrutinized, everything is being filmed, and you have a very angry Republican Party that is going to use him as part of the argument against her, he's going to have to be triply careful. And now his actions are not just a consequence to him and his party. There are consequences to his wife's candidacy.
Right. Thanks, Claire, for your call. Let's go next to Mary in Bennett. Marty. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello, Professor. Say, come on, you guys. I got to stick up for the millions of us who are really excited about Hillary Clinton.
All I hear
when I hear people talking about politics is the gross numbers of people who aren't excited about these candidates. You're forgetting that most of us have voted for Hillary. We're really excited about her candidacy. And are looking forward to having the first woman president in our history. So there's that. Parenthetically, Cory Booker, how exciting that would be if he was the vice president. I have heard there's some kind of skeleton in his closet, though. Would the professor happen to know what that is? I'm even afraid to ask.
Well, first of all, it's a good point, and it's one we often forget. Even with all the problems Hillary Clinton faces, she has very loyal supporters, and her candidacy is historic on many levels. And there's many she did very well still in the primaries, even though she was facing this really tough challenge, and she has a lot of reason to be optimistic that as she really gets to define what this campaign is about between her and Trump rather than her and fellow Democrats through Bernie Sanders, she's going to be able to bring out those who are excited about her. We'll hear more about that, and that will all change a bit the dynamics of the campaign. That said, she still has, you know, polls that show many people don't trust her, many people don't like her. That's a very real part of her candidacy. Cory Booker, a lot of people find exciting. He's young, he's dynamic, he's pretty effective with Twitter, which is, again, not insignificant given how Donald Trump is running his campaign. He's pretty progressive. One thing that is known, that is discussed, that he has close ties to Wall Street. He's also been on the side of education reform. Many teachers' unions have are skeptical about where he would go on the education issue. There are always all kinds of rumors. I'm not sure which you're talking about. That might circulate about a person's personal background, but right now nothing has come up that suggests there's any problems or that would be an issue that, you know, negates his candidacy.
Hmm. We've had several people address the email issue in Facebook and people who have left emails, so let me just put it all in one for you, wanting to know what exactly is the precedent of former secretaries of state and whether or not they used a private email server.
That's part of what came up during this investigation. We heard a little about Colin Powell's use of email. I'm not sure everyone understands even where this all comes from. It comes from the FOIA law, which was enacted in 1966, and the purpose of the law was to make sure that government officials kept all their records in the executive branch, and that the reason was we would have accountable leaders. The historians could look back at what happened. If there was any suggestion of wrongdoing, we would be able to see what happened. And as email emerged, so it's not that big a number that we're talking about of secretaries of state, this question has started to emerge as well. Initially, there wasn't any real serious policy about how do you catalog email correspondence. All they focused on was written documents. But as email became the primary way through which we communicate, there have been efforts to tighten the laws and rules surrounding how that material is handled and the rules about whether you can have a Google account or some additional account. And Hillary Clinton's one of the first Secretary of State to really feel the scrutiny of all these rules and regulations. So this is a new issue, and I think it's true that there's some confusion about how to handle all this, even if that doesn't excuse the way she decided to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Marty, thank you very much for being with us. And let's go to Joy, last caller, minute left in Green Bay. Hi, Joy.
Hi. There's a saying that says that organized lies are stronger than the truth. And I've been very concerned about this campaign. There seems to be a lot of organized misconceptions or, you know, inaccurate statements. And I wonder, do you think after this election balance that, or is this possibly the...
And Joy, your phone is cutting in and out. Is there one side more egregious than the other on this? Who are you upset about? Well, no.
Well, I couldn't hear the most of it.
I couldn't either.
And in terms of truth and politics, I think it's fair to say, if this is part of what she's talking about, we are now in an era where it's very hard to distinguish what's real and what's not. And it's not simply because occasionally candidates are not telling the truth or reporters make mistakes, but our organized information efforts, political ones, to spread certain narratives that are often not true to win campaigns and to win elections and to win public opinion. The media makes it, the internet and the media environment makes this very easy. And I don't think we're going to be able to roll back from this. You know, we have a lot of political fact sites and political fact reporters, but that doesn't seem to help. I think candidates are going to have to learn to navigate in a world where voters can't often or always tell truth from fiction.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us again, Professor Zelizer.
Thank you.
Professor Julian Zelizer, he has a new podcast. It's Politics and Polls. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books, including a very good one on Jimmy Carter and The Fierce Urgency of Now, which is about Lyndon Johnson and the civil rights bill and movement. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this show. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee.